Wells, Kelvin Park, Lane Tech, Lakeview, Roosevelt, Von Steuben. 1967, West Garfield Park, Upper Grade Center on Chicago's West Side. At West Garfield Park, the seventh and eighth grade classes were divided in what was deemed as smart to not so smart kids. There were 10 divisions. 8-1 was the smartest kids. 8-10 meant that you were dumb, and everybody knew this. Today, the thought of this hierarchy of misassessing and creating divisiveness amongst Black children already living under the umbrella of racism and classism is horrendous. Back then, I didn't care because I was in Division 8-1. It was in the spirit of specialness, superiority, and being smarter than better than those peons in Division 8-10 that I and my comrades of Division 8-1 were given a sheet of paper with a list of 20 schools, mostly white neighborhoods. None of us who had ever heard of them before. Seems like my parents hadn't either. They were inviting us so-called underprivileged, poor Black, but so-called smart kids to attend these schools, Chicago's answer to school integration, busing, something called permissive transfer. This meant that kids like me had the so-called privilege to attend schools outside our communities to these unheard-of white schools. I'd pore over that list night and day, trying to figure out which one of those schools I'd spend the next 4 years of my life. Steinmetz, Von Steuben, Lakeview it is. Why? I don't know. Perhaps it sounded better, lovelier, exotic even. Lakeview, a view of the lake. Anyway, September of 1967, having no idea what to expect, I boarded the bus, Chicago Transit Authority, that is, from my West Garfield Park neighborhood to the Lakeview High School at Irving Park in Ashland, a 90-minute trip each way. Although I'd been an excellent student at West Garfield Park Upper Grade Center, remember I was in Division 8-1, I soon discovered these Lakeview kids had been exposed to algebra, calculus, drafting. They'd even been dissecting frogs in grade school. I realized that we were not competing on equal playing fields, but I was determined to catch up and keep up, and I did. Even with all that travel time, which included pom-pom squad practices, performances, student council, newly formed Black Student Union, co-editor of the school newspaper, the Lake Review. Lakeview even had sororities. I joined Nikki's. So remember the women vitality, the girls with personality. Nikki's, we praise you. Between sophomore and junior year, I met and dated Brother McKinday. He was the same age as me, and he attended Parker High School on the South Side. He was a member of the Black Panther Party. He filled my head and heart with love of Black people and introduced me to African culture. I burned with cognizant dissonance as I no longer felt comfortable going into the homes of my white friends as a complimentary Black girl, while I was often asked by their parents, "So tell us, token Black girl, what's it like living in the ghetto?" Implication, it must be awful. By now, my family had moved to 91st and Eberhardt, a middle-class Black community that was nicer than many of the places my fellow Lakeviewites lived. My commute to Lakeview was up to 2.5 hours each way. Somewhere down the line, I realized that there was something wrong with this picture. Why were the so-called cream-of-the-crop Black kids plucked out of our communities to travel way across the city to schools where we clearly were not welcome? Why wouldn't Chicago's Board of Education balance the budget and fund poor Black schools? If integration was supposed to be the plan, why didn't they have those kids coming from Amundsen, Von Steuben, and Steinmetz and take CTA across the town to my neighborhood to attend Marshall High School? I got woke, wide awoke, as the nation was waking up and responding to the ills of systematic racism. The tipping point was when I, who had been a regular commodity in the homes of those white girls at overnight sorority parties, hosted a party in my neighborhood at 91st and Eberhardt. We lived in a nice brick bungalow across the street from Tule Park. Got all ready for the festivities, including preparing that French onion dip that those white girls seemed to love. I waited and waited and waited. Yet no one came. That is, nobody but Betty Queen. Betty Queen was a tall, awkward-looking white girl, self-proclaimed communist. I was saddened, later angry, that none of my so-called friends came to my party but Betty Queen. She and I became close during my latter years at Lakeview. I graduated from Lakeview High School in June of 1971, left with my belly full of hatred for that chosen experience. I hated white people and what I felt they represented, opportunities that were not afforded to me and my peers. In hindsight, I had absolutely no regrets for that Lakeview choice. For me, it was a mini experience in cultural diversity before that was even a thing. Before Lakeview, I didn't know there was any difference between Chinese and Japanese culture. I met Jewish kids and found out about bat and bar mitzvahs. Before Lakeview, I thought that everybody with a Spanish last name was either Mexican or Puerto Rican. I never knew that there were people so wealthy that in some of those Gold Coast high-rise apartments, when you open the elevator, somebody lives on the whole floor like Shelley Kaufman and her family. From Shelley Kaufman, I found out that some kids went away on spring break and had nose jobs. No such thing in my neighborhood. I no longer hate white people. Still, I'm not in denial that racism, which looks like disparity in police treatment, medical care, banking, day-to-day life, anti-Black microaggressions are real. I lived in Madison, Wisconsin between 2004 and 2010. I was appalled that too many white people there still referred to Black people as colored or Negro. Almost always, when I tell other than Black people in Madison that I was from Chicago, they seem surprised that I've never been in a game. I speak intelligently and I have common sense. Today, if someone were to ask me, what's it like living in the ghetto? I might just invite them over to my South Side Roseland home and see how true it is that they truly want to really get to know me. So, my name's Oroki and I'm an adult child and I'm living here in Chicago again on the South Side across the street from Gwendolyn Brooks College Preparatory, which if some of you may know, Gwendolyn Brooks was the first Black poet laureate and very well known. In fact, I got my first, I collect signed autograph books. I got the first, my first book. My mom went to go see Gwendolyn Brooks. She was an avid reader. So let me tell you a little bit about who my mama and daddy is. I meant to do this so I could screenshot, but this is them. That's my mom and dad. That is Jeremiah Washington White Jr. And my mama is Juanita White. And at this point in time, I don't know what was going on. My daddy was lying about his age. He was a much older man than he said. Not much, but he probably was 5 years at least older than he told my mama he was. He was older than her daddy. Than her mama, rather. So that's my mama and daddy, and they gave birth together to this person, little me, and that was me. And so, oh yeah, they gave birth to me, the firstborn daughter. And I have to say, I before I started talking earlier, I almost cried. Not that I hid it, but I wanted to. I had a progression. I wanted to start off with that piece originally, but I have to thank my friends, including my sister, who is on this line right now. That just means so much to me that she's there, because that's her mom and daddy too. And we grew up in the same household, same mama, same bedroom until I got married and moved out the house at 21 years old. Even I had a baby, and that baby was in that bedroom with my sister. She helped me with that baby that raised my oldest daughter. So my daddy, again, was born in the early 1900s. I don't know, 1910 or so. We're not really sure again because he was lying about how old he was. And because he was old messing with my young mama. And so he was in World War II in the Navy, and very, very, very bitter man. The bitterness killed him. Alcoholism by himself, alone in a flea bag hotel. They found him because they smelled something in there, and they found him in there. So he was my primary abuser, but I'm not letting Mama off the hook, who was a wonderful woman in all many ways, but also was an abused child herself. My mother was born in Mississippi, down in the cotton fields of the Delta area in Mississippi. Her mama was 14, 15 years old when she got pregnant and had my mother. We don't know who my grandfather was. My grandmother never revealed that. By the time my grandmother wanted to talk, she had dementia and she was saying any kind of thing. So we don't know. My sister and I don't know our grandfather directly. Some DNA stuff is going on too, but still we don't know them. But they were both very unhappy, very sad people, although my mother did her best to make sure that it looked like there was a lot of joy. So my mother loved everybody. My mother, I was born in 1953, 2 years before Emmett Till was killed in Mississippi, who came out of Chicago. And that racism was not talked about in our household. My daddy hated white people. No, I'm putting this on the table right now. But he hated everything. He didn't just hate white people, he hated everything. I would not say he hated me, but he mistreated me. So he would tell my sister and I think we could not have pierced ears. So I got a whole lot of pierced stuff going on right now. We couldn't have pierced it because he said that was savage. We couldn't wear red fingernail polish. That was savage. You know, wild women did that. Hussies wore red nail polish. I was thinking the other day, getting my sister's on here. I have to check with her on that. We couldn't wear flip-flops. And I think that was my mother's something, why we didn't wear flip-flops. I got a whole box of probably 10 flip-flops in there right now. So a whole lot of stuff I do out of reaction to stuff that happened to me in childhood. So I didn't really know the climate of the country. Yeah, I was born in 1953. Emmett Till's killed and all this stuff is going on. The world is on fire, literally. My neighborhood is literally on fire. When Dr. King was killed, we lived on one of the major streets in Chicago, and the bus went down our street, and we saw the tanks of the National Guard, literally saw this. We saw Pulaski Avenue up the street aflame. You know, that was very terrifying, but nobody explained any of that. They sent me to Lakeview High School, and they didn't tell me, and I'm talking about parents now. They didn't say, we can send you over to the school that's got 3,000 kids, and you're going to be one of the first 15 Black kids, and they're not going to like you over there. They're going to throw bricks at you. They're going to try to beat you all up. They're going to call you the N-word over there. They didn't explain that to me. I had to do that all on my own, how to figure that out. But I did a lot of figuring stuff out on my own. And my mother, bless her heart, she just loved everybody. We belonged to a church. We had a white pastor who was a kind of a revolutionary guy. And he had two daughters that Amy and Ann played with me and my sister. We went to the beach with them. And, you know, it didn't feel like anything racist about that relationship at all with us. But they didn't explain that. I don't think I really knew that what was going on in the world, that all of this systematic racism, classism, hatred that was going, I don't think I really knew it until well into that Lakeview experience. The first years, I didn't even really know what was going on with that then. But then at some point, I realized that the world is unjust. And really, it was when I had to write a paper, a term paper, senior year. Well, I was probably in like about junior year because I was dating McKinley by that time. And I had to write a paper. And my paper was supposed to be why Lincoln freed the slaves. And as I began to do research as a high school, I was like, that's not what happened. He did that because he needed to untie up the country. It had nothing to do with he was had this compassion for my people. And when I found that out, when I wrote that paper, I was like, changed my mind a lot about a lot of things. But again, I am the mother, I'm the child of my mother who said, you love everybody, but I had to figure out, yeah, I can love people, but I don't have to respect them. So I've been in ACA now consistently since the beginning of the pandemic now. I go to 5 meetings a week. Thank you for my people. I see friends from last night Zoom Boom Room. I see on here right now, and people I know from the BIPOC community. And that's the thing too. I discovered the BIPOC community, BIPOC, Black Indigenous People of Color. And it's so funny, people will ask me. So again, I discovered, I've been here 4 years. I discovered BIPOC maybe a year and a half ago. So some of my ally friends and some of them not so much ally. What are you doing in those meetings? You know, what happened to Rogi? Because, you know, I go to the same meetings. They notice I wasn't there. Well, I'm going to BIPOC on these particular days. What are you doing there? What is BIPOC? Is that like bisexual? What is that? So, you know, I'm like, you can look that up. And really, you can look up everything today. You can Google everything. People who didn't know what Juneteenth, all you gotta do is look up Juneteenth, see what it is today. So, I experienced, even very recently, as recent as this week, I experienced microaggression sometimes in ACA meetings that are not necessarily BIPOC friendly. I have had people tell me sometimes, you know, some, if you know me, I wear head wraps. I always wear a hat or head wrap. I had somebody send me a check during the meeting saying, I like your hat. And it wasn't a hat I was wearing. It was a head wrap. It was like that. And they sent me a check and said, oh, I like your head wrap. You know, why are you telling me that? Or, you know, I hear the all lives matter. Yeah, all lives matter. But if Black lives mattered the way they were supposed to matter, we wouldn't have to say Black lives matter. And I don't accept, and some people on here know who are on here know I have had to call them on this. I don't let white people call me girl. You just can't do that. I got too much historical stuff that goes with that. And if you don't know what that means, look it up because you can look that up. There's plenty of articles why white women can't call Black women girl. And let me make this clear. I am not speaking for Black people. I'm speaking for Oroki who lives in Chicago on the South Side of Chicago. I'm not even speaking for the people in Chicago. I'm speaking my experience, strength, and hope right now. And so, you know, I have white people ask me, like, they want me to speak for Black people, for what, you know, like, well, Oroki said, so it must be true because it must be true about Black people. And even Black people don't necessarily agree on the same thing. We can't even agree sometimes on what we call ourselves. I personally prefer to be called either Black or African. To me, African American softens the experience. And I like Black. Black just sounds good. Boom. So that's my story there. But I am just a grateful member of ACA where I get to tell the truth and tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So and that people are willing and want to hear that. So if I have, if I never, if you call me girl and I never told you, don't call me girl, you probably ain't my friend for real. So if I told you, I said it to you out of love because I care about our friendships. You know, I also had this experience this week where somebody, a white ally, wanted to, every conversation we have turns to about me being Black. And I know I knew a Black person when I was in 8th grade. You know, I get that a lot too. I used to know my teacher used to be Black, whatever, but I don't need to hear that. You know, tell your white friends that. Don't tell me that. And again, I just say what how I experience life and the microaggressions that I experience regularly. I was living, again, I lived in Madison, Wisconsin. At one point they touted it as the city of diversity or something. I didn't know that at the time. I know that that wasn't true. The only Madison I knew at the time, my sister was a student at the university. I thought Madison was all like that, university life, which is also still very racist too. But so I'm thinking I'm going to this city, this, you know, everybody get along. And so a friend of mine and I were leaving, a white friend and I were leaving the Madison Public Library on a Sunday. And I was dressed up because I like to get dressed up. My granny taught us girls how to dress.
5 minutes.
Thank you. And so we would, I was dressed up. We're leaving because I had been to church that Sunday. And culturally speaking, where I came from, you get dressed up to go to church. You know, this new jeans wearing and sweatshirt. You know, that's a whole nother thing. I don't even go to church no more. But so I'm dressed up leaving the church and leaving the library with my white friend Charlotte, who has on jeans. In fact, she had overalls on that had paint on them, and she looked pretty messy, but that's who she was. And so we're leaving out the library together, and the alarm goes off. Who knew that they had alarms in libraries? But the alarm goes off as we, security alarm, as we're leaving out. They let Charlotte keep walking. They brought me, security brings me, who's all dressed up. They bring me back into the library. And they want to search me now, like I'm stealing books from the library. That's another story. I might do that, but I wasn't stealing books that day. You know? So they bring me back in, and when it was all over, I'm walking out with Charlotte, and Charlotte saw what happened directly. She saw what happened, and she said, "How do you live with that?" It's like, what can I do? I can't peel this off, which I wouldn't want to if I could, but. I live with it. So I've learned, especially since I've been in ACA, I've been learning more how to speak up and say what's acceptable and not acceptable. I like to tell people, I'm like Oprah. I'm like, Oprah love everybody, but Oprah will check you if you get out of line. And that's like, I like to think who I am, is that I speak up. My name, Oroki, means a protector. And I like to believe that I was given the job by my higher power to protect my culture and protect the children. And I have such a heart. I've always had a heart for children. I've been a teacher before, a primary school teacher. I've owned a daycare before. Children like me. Troubled children know I know something. I'm on the bus. I ride public transportation in Chicago, and I'll be on the bus. And a mother will get on the bus. She may be, I can look at her and tell she's like 22 years old. She got four kids. She got one of those big strollers, and she got all these kids packed into the stroller. They're drinking blue something. They're eating flaming hots. And, you know, they're on the bus and they're crying, and she hollering at them and slapping them up the head. Didn't I tell you to shut up and all that? So, and it just breaks my heart when I see that. But I'm an activist. I'm gonna do something. I'm not just gonna sit there sad. I'm not gonna get in her business and say, "Girl, why are you talking to them kids like that?" What I will do is I will make contact with the children, and the children see I see them, and they look me in the eyes, and I may wave at them and smile at them, and their eyes may brighten up. And this is what I've learned to do. I will say to that girl, young mother, "You know what? You must be a special woman." And she's looking at me like crazy, lady. You know, why are you talking to me? I'm dealing with these damn kids. And I say, "You must be a special lady." And she goes, she's looking at me puzzled. And I said, "Because if God gave you those kids, because I can tell, this is what I'm telling, I can tell those are some special kids right now. So if God gave you those special kids to take care of that came through you, you must be some kind of woman." And she may look at me and smile. I've never had a bad experience with that. She may look at me and smile. Sometimes we may even embrace, and I may hug her. Sometimes she may even cry. But she might get off that bus and slap the kid up the head again. But at least she might remember that lady on the bus one day who said that to her then. So that's my job. That's my mama living through. If you follow me on social media, you know I have a hashtag. My mama is proud. Thank you. My mama is so proud of both her daughters. And the work we do to tell the truth, expose the culture, and live out loud. Because I'll be 71 years old next month. And y'all know me, I'm living out loud. It says one of our promises is that we learn to play and have fun in our life. My mama gave me that skill. And again, even in her own sadness, she wanted the best. Even my daddy with his stuff, he loved us. He just, the dysfunction, societal dysfunction, his own family dysfunction beat him down and it killed him. And so I don't have to live like that. I can be an example to my children, to my grandchildren, my three daughters. Y'all know I got three daughters, eight granddaughters, and I'm proud of them girls that didn't go out, it didn't turn out the way I thought it was going to be, but I love them all, and I'm so grateful to be here. I love you all, and with that, thanks for listening, and I'm grateful. Mwah.